Good morning and welcome to the roundtable. And we're very happy to have you on this Monday, a holiday for many, as you may have already noticed, not for us, but that's okay. we're not bitter or anything. No, but hopefully you are home and enjoying the day, Indigenous Peoples Day. And I know, is Bart off today?
Yes.
Yeah.
I do this for fun, Joe.
Yeah, no, I know. I was just.
This is
I was
our
just,
holiday.
And Skidmore's off?
No.
Okay. Yeah, no, see, that's the thing. In. Like, I notice it's sort of a split thing. So, whatever. But I'm happy you're all here and thrilled that we get to do the show today because there is a lot going on in the world. And we will talk about that in just a moment. I want to real quick. Just thank some people. On Saturday, I was lucky enough to be at the Eleanor Roosevelt Band Book Awards in Poughkeepsie. I had talked about this on the air before, and I was lucky enough to talk and to do the keynote. It wasn't the keynote. It was the fireside chat with the Lifetime Achievement Award winner, Margaret Atwood. And it was amazing. Yeah. She is incredible. An amazing woman, a lovely, lovely human being. She read my palm, y'all. It was amazing.
Any surprises?
Yes. Yes. My integrity line goes very far and then deviates, is what she said. So I don't know, quite know. She said that could be bad, that could be bad, could be good, could be bad, we don't know. And then she said, and then all kinds of funky things start happening. I'm like, all right, do tell, Margaret. It was just a perfect evening honoring those who are on the front lines, authors, librarians, of course, booksellers and artists and people who are trying to get the written word out, and their efforts are being stalled and stymied. There are a million people to thank, but I will simply say that Samantha Shapley, who is the managing director of the Eleanor Roosevelt Center, was the ringleader of this and did just a stunningly beautiful job. Not only is she one of the nicest people I've ever met in my life, I got to meet her son, Ben, who's an eighth grader. And he is a young baseball player who is destined for great things, and not just because he grew up listening to WAMC. we had just a wonderful, wonderful time. And so a quick story, and then we'll get to the news. But I'm in Eleanor Roosevelt's dressing room. Yes, I'm in Margaret Atwood's dressing room. And we're talking about our talk, about what we're going to talk about and things. You know, I just want to see if there's things she wants me to ask or not ask or whatever the case may be. And we're having a lovely conversation. And all of a sudden I realize that there's a microphone over us and there's a camera behind me. And I sort of looked to my right and I looked to my left and I looked up and she said, "Oh, they're from 60 Minutes." I was like, oh.
Oh, just that.
Oh.
And here comes Leslie Stahl.
Yeah, that's right. It was very cool. And but an amazing evening. And I just want to thank all the folks there who did just a brilliant job. And to the other award winners and Oblong Books and Susanna Hermans and all of our friends, it was just a glorious event and an absolute thrill to be a part of it. Oh, what I was going to say is once we realize when they're going to air it, then we'll have rights to the audio once 60 Minutes has their way with it. Then we'll have rights to the audio and we'll be able to run the interview. So that will be coming, I hope.
And it looks like you met my colleague, Josh Bettiger.
Nicest man.
Yeah.
Nicest man. And was representing the Roosevelt family.
Right. Yeah. It's a wonderful, as my boss likes to say, a wonderful American story. The great-grandson of Eleanor Roosevelt is the Jewish chaplain at Bard.
Yes.
Where Eleanor was on the board for a while. She used to spend a lot of time at Bard. But Now he's back, continuing the family legacy in a new way.
And had beautiful remarks.
Yeah.
Beautiful remarks at the event. That's number one. Number two is that on Friday we'll be at Bard. It's the Hannah Arendt Conference that will be taking place on Friday. We will not be broadcasting the conference, but we will be right next door, and we'll be talking to many of the participants, and we will be there and having just in the subject of the conference is joy, and we thought we need that. So we'll talk about that, and we'll have a great group and amazing guests who are coming and joining us. So we're very excited about that as well. That's Friday. I believe tickets for the audience are sold out, but if that changes, I will let you all know. Bo Breslin is here, Joseph Palamountain, Jr. Chair in Government at Skidmore College. Good morning, Bo. How are you?
Joe, I'm very good. And I want to just express gratitude to you and WAMC for going to Bard and taking in or participating in some way in an academic conference. Too often these academic conferences have too small audiences for WAMC to come to Bard and maybe eventually Skidmore for a Sal Magundy conference. It's just great to hear.
See what he did there? That was good.
On air pitch.
That was good. Yeah, get that in. No, yeah, put a little pressure on us. Oh, we would love to.
Yeah.
I think it's just great. And the guests are amazing, and it's fantastic to talk to everybody. So yeah, we'll work on that. Jim Ketterer is with us. He is senior fellow Bard Center for Civic Engagement. And did you have your first event?
We did. In fact, I wanted to thank you. So a couple weeks ago, you interviewed Terry Gordon and I from the Art Stanton Quartet about the grant that we have to create this new suite of music and spoken word based on the novel The Sheltering Sky by Paul Bowles. So we had our very first event on Saturday. It was a full house, and I think that's in large part due to you interviewing us and getting the word out that was happening, and we're going to do a lot more performances. Went very well. It's always a little nerve-wracking to do it the very first time and see how it's going to go from beginning to end, but I think all of us in the band were happy with it, and the audience seemed to like it, and so more to come.
You don't need me to tell you this, but you all seemed like you had your act together.
Well, I'm glad we seemed that way, but you know, it's only real until you get up there and perform in front of actual live people.
You're doing a wonderful thing, and people can find out what your website is.
ArchStantonJazz.com.
ArchStantonJazz.com, and you can find out about this incredible project that'll be going throughout Albany County. So, very important stuff. Finally, we welcome Malia Dumont, Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College. Good morning, Malia. The good news is we're coming to Bard. The bad news is we're going to miss you because you're ending up, you were invited to be a guest at a conference, and you're now running it.
It's strange ways that the government shutdown affects us in unexpected ways.
Well, you'll be there in spirit, and you're helping us so much, so we thank you very, very much, and delight to have you here. Thank you. All right, let's begin with the news of the day. As I said, obviously, it's a busy news day, and things are shifting at every moment, and a lot going on. Israeli hostages exchanged for Palestinian prisoners. That just of several hours ago, Hamas freed the 20 prisoners. And this is really looking at something that we've been talking about for so long. And Israel released some 2,000 Palestinian prisoners as part of a ceasefire. President Trump in Israel proclaimed an, quote, end to the war, but Israel and Hamas have not agreed on next steps in Gaza. So all of that is there. The hostages in Gaza were returned to Israel on Monday. Nearly 2,000 Palestinian prisoners were freed from Israeli jails as part of the ceasefire that President Trump hailed as the end of the war. That was before cheering members of Israel's parliament. The agreement that Trump helped broker has left many unanswered questions over whether Israel and Hamas can reach a lasting peace and over the future of Gaza, which has been devastated by 2 years of war. Under the ceasefire deal, Hamas released 20 hostages from Gaza early Monday morning as Trump arrived in Israel. Hours later, the Israeli authorities said that they had finished freeing all 1,968 Palestinian prisoners slated for release as part of the hostage exchange. Mr. Trump said the agreement marked the historic dawn of a new Middle East. He was expected to head to a summit next on the ceasefire deal in Egypt. That's where he's headed now. In fact, I believe the plane is en route as we speak, leaving Tel Aviv. And the summit of the ceasefire deal in Egypt, along with many other world leaders, the Egyptian government said that the president of the Palestinian Authority would participate in the summit, but Mr. Netanyahu's office said he would not, citing a Jewish religious holiday. Among both Israelis and Palestinians, the ceasefire and the start of the exchange brought relief and hope. Malia, let's begin with you.
The last time I was on this program was about a week and a half ago, and that was the morning after the proposal had been floated. And we talked through it then, and I expressed at that time some guarded optimism about where this could lead and that it seemed like it was going to open more doors than previous peace proposals had. But I did not anticipate that we would be here so quickly. So I've been thinking about how did this, what looked like a more positive opening, actually ended up in this historic exchange and hopefully more than just a temporary end to the conflict. And I think one of the key factors is that Hamas in its essence, it's an insurgency, and insurgencies cannot exist without external support. And the external support for Hamas and its sister, Hezbollah, have been decimated over the past year. Previous peace proposals, some of them looked similar to what was floated just a week and a half ago, but they didn't go as far because the external sources of support for the insurgency of Hamas didn't have a reason to really support or participate. And in the intervening time, since those previous proposals didn't really go anywhere, Iran has been really negatively affected. The Arab states that surround Israel have not been providing as much support to Hamas. And so Hamas was really left with little other choice. And so that's, I think, in a nutshell, putting a very broad description on it, I think that's why we're here at this point and why we couldn't have been here earlier.
Jim?
I haven't been on in a while, so it feels like there's so much happens in any news cycle, and then if you're not on for quite a while, there's a lot to catch up on. But, there is certainly credit due to Donald Trump and the people around him for forcing this issue in a way that, as you said, Malia, really fast-tracked it in I think ways that many people who have worked on Israel-Palestine issues for decades didn't really anticipate. That having been said, also, as you said, Malia, many of the things in this broader plan were included in lots of other plans, including the Biden plan that brought the ceasefire just as the Trump administration was coming in and just as Donald Trump was saying that he was going to create a Riviera in Gaza and displace all the Palestinians. So he's changed his mind about that, which I think is a good thing because that would constitute ethnic cleansing, which is a crime against humanity. So that's a good direction it's good to go away from a crime against humanity. Joe, I just wanted to mention one thing, too. In your intro, you talked about the release of the hostages, which I think is historically important and not just politically the right thing to do for Hamas, but is long long overdue and has lots of ripple effects in the complexities of Israeli politics. But also you mentioned the release of Palestinian prisoners. And there is this consistent distinction between hostages and prisoners. And there is a sense when one uses, and I'm not criticizing you, Joe, because I think this is what is generally standard in the press, that all of the Palestinians included in that 1900 plus have gone through some sort of due process and that there's some kind of criminal justice system that then has put them in prison as prisoners, distinct from hostages. And there are some in that group who are in that category and in fact are being released and almost instantaneously deported. And so that's less reported, but it is happening. Many of the others, about 1,700 of them, were people who were just swept up through these years of conflict with no due process whatsoever and held with no charge whatsoever. And so I'm not sure what right word is, perhaps detainee. I'm not sure, Malia, what the military uses for people who are initially swept up in those situations. But I just thought I would highlight that distinction because I think it's important for people to realize that many of the Palestinians who are being released have been held incommunicado from their families, too, and charged with nothing. And so this is a good thing on both sides that this is happening and this release is happening. And we're up against the
hour. No, you're
hour.
Okay. You're okay.
So let me just say we know that this has happened, this release, very historic. The Israeli military has pulled back, but they have not pulled out of Gaza. They still control 55%. They've pulled back to the yellow line. And so they still control on the ground 55% of Gaza. Also about who's been released, it's important to note one person who was not released, Marwan Barghouti, who is really the person who is most likely to be a leader who could unite lots of different factions across Gaza and the West Bank. And I want to talk about the West Bank in a little bit because we should not leave that out of this equation. We also know immediately many Gazans are returning, particularly to North Gaza. I think about 200,000 have returned. And just imagine, on a human level, you have that number of people returning to a place that has been absolutely leveled. There's nothing in many neighborhoods, not a building standing, no infrastructure, no sanitary system, no health system, no educational system, nothing. And so it's not just a question of like, well, who will rebuild Gaza in the long term? How will these people live day to day in the short term? This is going to take an enormous lift. And I assume this is one of the things that's going to be talked about a lot in Sharm el-Sheikh, where President Trump is headed and other world leaders are headed. But it's no minor thing. And when you're dealing with these conflict zones, you're having to deal with lots of other issues. There's going to be a lot of unexploded weapons that, when I worked in the Balkans, there were people being killed for years afterwards, walking into places where there was an unexploded bomb or minefields, there was this, there was that. Also, we were already seeing with the Israeli pullback that the complexities of an immediate post-conflict situation, like days after the end of this immediate conflict, it gets ugly and it gets weird. There was a very prominent Palestinian journalist who was killed yesterday, and he was killed by anti-Hamas militias who were generally assumed to be working with the support of Israel, of the Israeli government. And so it's not just kind of, oh, there's Hamas, there's Israel. There are so many other complexities. And these complexities come to the fore as you try to piece things back together. As I said about the West Bank, there's no ceasefire in the West Bank. There's no pullback of Israelis. There's over 500,000 Israeli settlers living in the West Bank. There are over 200,000 in East Jerusalem. There has been, over the last several years, so much going on, and I think it's been really underreported as the Gaza conflict has been going on, that's likely to ramp back up, I think, in our attention. And the last thing I would say, with regard to Egypt, where I used to live, and I'm going back in a couple weeks, I'll be very interested to see that as the Israeli government works with the Trump administration on this, and the Israeli and the Egyptian government works with the Trump administration, and the Egyptian government that has worked with the Israeli government hand in glove on this issue over many years, including during the conflict, the Egyptian government is no friend of Hamas at all. In fact, just quite the opposite. The Muslim Brotherhood used to be in power in Egypt, and they were displaced by a coup by the Egyptian military. And the Egyptian military is no friends of the Muslim Brotherhood, and Hamas is an outgrowth of the Muslim Brotherhood. And so there is a real split between what the Egyptian government is doing and all the Arab states, what they're doing to work now on this issue. Can they do it in a way that doesn't leave them completely disconnected from the sentiment of their own populations? And so the potential for ripple effects across the Arab world, political ripple effects, as these governments get drawn into this conflict but out of step with their own populations, keep an eye on that. I think there could be some other medium-term issues popping up there.
Bo Breslin.
Yeah, always hard to follow Malia and Jim, but let me add a couple of things. They're both right. First of all, from a domestic policy perspective, I'm going to say it as a Democrat, just like Jim did, Trump deserves credit. And that's something that's important. And Democrats, in trying to bridge the divide between Republicans and Democrats, they need to acknowledge that. It's frustrating and to think about the ways in which we contextualize it. But Trump deserves credit in this moment. But more importantly, as a political scientist, I want to think about this from the political perspective. And in particular, Malia's right. Hamas was sort of backed into a corner, didn't have much option. I think Bibi Netanyahu didn't have much of an option. So, and when we think about how we got here, Malia, especially in light of, let's just take the last month, I think it's fair to say that Netanyahu overplayed his hand by bombing Hamas leadership in Doha. That was probably the important moment in which, because what happens is you get all the Arab states or many of the Arab states furious, right? And you talk about, Jim, you talk about Egypt not liking the Muslim Brotherhood and so on. But when you get the Arab states all rallying around that sort of beyond the pale moment mm-hmm. of Hamas leadership in Doha, and you awaken Trump to the reality that Netanyahu himself can be, you know, can calculate wrongly. And so I think in that moment, that's the thing that probably sealed the deal for eventually the way in which we got here. Now, I'll say two other things. One is, if anybody saw the speech today, Netanyahu's speech today, I was talking to Jim about this before, Netanyahu was gushing about Trump. Trump's the best friend that Israel's ever had in the White House, all that sort of thing. You know, Netanyahu is not dumb. And the reality is, I think he recognizes his future as a leader in Israel is tied, at least in the moment, to Trump's friendship. And so I don't see that Netanyahu can abandon or do some of the things that he's done in the past where he's talked out of one side of his mouth and about American involvement and participation and then done things differently. I actually think in this particular moment, he is tied, his future is tied to the friendship that he forged and has with Donald Trump. And then the last thing I'll say is that I think that when it comes to the far-right coalition, you've got Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, both of which on the Israeli side, both of which have voted against this. So the question is, to what extent will that coalition hold up? And I think as it's easy for Israel and Bibi Netanyahu to agree to phase one, right? Humanitarian aid, hostage release, ceasefire, as Jim said, moving Israeli troops back to a yellow line. The rubber is going to hit the road when they get into phase two, right? Where, you know, is there a pathway, a possible pathway to Palestinian statehood? And even phase three, that's where I think we're going to see Netanyahu play politics in a way that right now he's not playing, because it's all celebration. It's all slapping him on the back and congratulating him for getting to this point. But phase two is not something that the current coalition, Israeli coalition government, can afford to move to. And it'll be interesting to watch what happens.
Jim?
Yeah, so that was great, Bo. But I think about Palestinian statehood, if that is in fact where this might be headed, that can't just be Gaza. That has to also include the West Bank. And that's, I think, even more important to Smotrich and Ben-Gvir than Gaza. Also, the idea that eventually the Palestinian Authority would be the entity that would have some unified governance of both West Bank and Gaza. This has been an entity that has been systematically undermined and weakened over decades. And so to reverse that is going to be very difficult, because there are many Palestinians who don't see the Palestinian Authority with any kind of positive thought. Also, in the intermediate part, the idea that the plan would have this kind of colonial protectorate of Gaza, that you would have a variety of international forces doing some difficult things, enforcing an Israeli withdrawal, enforcing the disarming of Hamas. And anytime you have to enforce something means you have to be ready to use force. And that will be a very difficult call in those specific circumstances. Also, putting Tony Blair at the head of this, number one, I mean, to bring back the British into the Middle East, just a little skimming of history can give us a sense, like,
a little ironic.
That's really might not be a good idea. And Tony Blair, who many Americans might not remember, but people in the Middle East sure remember, was one of the architects and cheerleaders of the ill-fated invasion of Iraq in 2003. Then he also, after he was out of office, he ran an organization called the Quartet, to deal with peace issues. And this was not a raging success either. And so he comes with lots of baggage. The British come with lots of baggage. And it does send the message that when you combine this kind of idea that you would have the Palestinian Authority that is so weakened and so discredited in the eyes of many of their own people, and you have Tony Blair at the head of this protectorate, that there's no real sense that the Palestinians would be anything other than a vassal state that lacks any semblance of sovereignty.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have some letters. We'll tackle some more aspects of the story. And again, we welcome you. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll continue our conversation after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion on this Monday morning, the 13th of October. We thank you very much for being with us. Bo Breslin, Malia Dumont, and Jim Ketterer are guests. We are talking about the Middle East and what has been happening this morning with hostages freed and a peace deal that is being worked on and ultimately will continue to be discussed throughout the day as the president makes his way now to Egypt. I just want to read this one letter from a listener, and it'll sort of get us maybe on a slightly different track, not really, but a little bit, which is, and we can talk about the substance of it in a minute, but Cheryl says, we should be pleased that Trump has apparently been able to stop the war and loss of life in Gaza and Israel. However, while he is gathering accolades abroad, he has left his own federal government shut down and in shambles. He left his own citizens fired and wondering how they will survive. So much for America First. Shame on him. So the politics of this is that, I mean, this is a huge deal. You said this. He deserves credit. But you do have to look at this in the larger picture, too.
Yeah, and he said, and I'm sure Jim and Malia have something to say about this, too. Maureen Dowd had had the best, one of the best op-ed pieces I've seen in a long time when she said, you know, shame on him for promoting democracy abroad and destroying it at home. There's truth to that. But what, and Cheryl's right. What I keep going back to, and I'd love for us to have this conversation about the Democratic agenda, platform, plan, narrative moving forward. One of the things that I think is problematic when you see Hakeem Jeffries and Mike Lawler fighting on the House floor is that there's no common vocabulary. There's no ability to talk about this. And so when some credit is deserving of the Republicans, I have to go on air and say there is some credit due here in this situation. Do I think that Trump is destroying democracy at home? Cheryl's right. Yes, I do. But do I think that he moved the needle in the Middle East and in this conflict? I do think that too.
Jim?
Yeah. I mean, I think Cheryl is right. Tom Friedman also said something about that in his column that was largely about the Middle East, but was saying, well, look home. What's happening here? What's going on? And I think was saying if Donald Trump really wants to go down as a great president and that gets accolades across the board, why is he not, you know, attending to these things in the United States? In fact, he's doing the opposite. He's creating these problems. And so I do wonder if there would be anybody around the president who would say, you know, if you should look at this Friedman piece, you should think about this kind of thing because this could actually work well for you politically, but also in terms of your legacy and your profile, which seems to be something that he's highly focused on. And it seems to me that that's not happening around him or he's not listening to it. But I do see it. I see more and more of this kind of, you know, distinction between what's happening overseas and what's happening within the United States. And I wonder to what extent it might start to bubble up within his base support. We've seen some interesting critique from Marjorie Taylor Greene, for instance. So I wonder to the extent that this might find some life beyond just a few columnists and one member of the House.
Yeah, I was thinking of this on my drive up here because I was listening to some of what he said when he was addressing the Knesset just within the past couple hours. And Donald Trump expressed empathy in a way I haven't heard him do in the United States. He's talking about, you all haven't known peace for so long. Hopefully this is a great day bringing peace. And just expressing a sense of solidarity and humanity that I thought, wow, this is kind of extraordinary. Does it take adulation of him for him to be able to express those kind of things? Because certainly he's much more popular in Israel now than I think he is in the United States. But it's striking and it's very odd. And I think there is this strange schism that is going to be reflected more and more in our politics, I think.
Yeah. So one quick thing that I wonder about is, so in that same speech, he also decided he was going to use that venue to take some political pot shots at Barack Obama and Joe Biden. And so I wonder.
He never does that.
Yeah. I mean, this was a moment to like really take the high road, take credit, but also express those things that you were just mentioning, Malia. So I wonder for people in the listening audience who are supportive, deeply supportive of the president, how does that, is that good? Is that something that you find useful? That kind of petty schoolyard bully kind of attitude, even at this very historic positive moment? I mean, how does that work? Because, I mean, it doesn't work for me, but I'd like to hear from someone who is otherwise supportive of the president and say, well, I don't know, fill in the blank. I'm not sure what that blank is. Sorry, Bo.
Yeah, no worries. Let me just throw three things out there. One is, what's the common denominator? Malia, you're right. You know, he showed empathy. What the common denominator for Trump is so simple, right? It is, he appreciates those who are fawning him. He appreciates those who can demonstrate power, probably disproportionate to what the democracy would suggest. So he's, you know, he's friends with the North Korean president and Bibi Netanyahu, probably has more power than he'd like that. And he's Erdogan and Orban and these leaders that demonstrate power in ways. So those two things are common denominators. The thing that that I go back to on a domestic point is that American politics is such that the president at the moment is involved, whether he likes it or not, in most of what goes on a daily basis, right? And so what happens on an international front is he can parachute in, save the day in Israel. We give him credit for it, but he cannot get out of his own way domestically because everything sort of siphons through the executive branch, and he wants it that way. And so the day-to-day press paying attention to the president's every word and every sentence makes it so that that he and the Democrats, the Republicans and the Democrats, probably can never really get on the same page about this sort of stuff. But it's easy to do foreign policy for a little while because you parachute in and you parachute out, right? He doesn't have to spend all his time thinking about Israel or all his time thinking about Ukraine. And one interesting thing I'll say, Joe, to finish this off is how many of the press really paid attention to the fact that there was a telephone call between Zelensky and Trump just a few days ago, where Zelensky said, if you can solve that problem, you can solve our problem too. That's part of the, you know, that's part of the game that Europeans also often play with Trump, is you play him up and then he becomes your best friend.
It seems like so often in the political analysis on this show and many, many others, where we talk about priorities, people will often say, well, you know, you can do two things at one time. You can do both. Can you do both here? I mean, can you do what he's doing in the Middle East and take that credit and then see what's happening domestically and not expect there to be some sort of through line and understanding that what and I simply mean by this a peaceful resolution that could come out of the domestic issues that we're facing.
Yeah, and what I found to be, the answer is yes, you can do both. What I found to be a little ironic about this situation is the fact that there's the peaceful, you know, his Trump's sort of straight ahead, let's get peace in the Middle East, it's an odd juxtaposition thinking about the quote-unquote lack of peace in Portland and Chicago, right?
Right.
Those are much more easily quote-unquote solvable than the Middle East conflict. And yet, I think using the Insurrection Act that the Trump administration wants to use, focusing on Chicago and Portland as places that are filled with chaos and violence and so on, that fulfills or continues the Trump agenda domestically in a way that plays right to his base.
But I also think that, and I think we're going to talk about this in depth later, but since you brought it up, Beau, the difference is it's not just what's going to get him accolades, but unlike Israel, Gaza, what's going on domestically will affect him politically as we come up to 2026. And I think so much of the Insurrection Act, the use of troops, so many other things that are happening has to do with the coming 2026 midterm elections, that if the House were to swing Democratic, this would absolutely, he sees it would be absolutely existentially important. It's as important as a presidential election for him because it could cripple him politically. And so he is looking at that through a very different lens than what's possible in the Middle East or in Ukraine.
Let's go to a couple of letters that we have on the subject. John says, I think we know what phase two will be for the people of Palestine. It will be leaving the area, and when they will not be allowed back. Trump has already said it will be a perfect place for resorts and casinos. This is what you were referring to earlier. And, of course, a Trump tower.
You know, it's understandable that the letter writer would focus on that, given what the president has said before. But in the deal, it specifically says there that that will not happen. And so I'm not sure what has gone into changing his mind on this. I think that he has probably been given some very serious consultations, he or his people, from the Egyptians and from the aforementioned Tony Blair and others who just said, like, you know, that's not only a crime against humanity, that should be enough to stop it, but it's also going to lead to lots of other problems as ripple effects. And so if you can take the deal seriously, and it's his deal, that issue is apparently off the table.
Chris writes, isn't this simply a case of Trump being the mega bully to Bibi's lesser bully? I can't wait to learn what deal was made between these two and whether it's to anyone's long-term benefit other than to Netanyahu and Trump.
I mean, like I said, I actually think, you know, politics is... is not a crystal ball. It's unclear, and I think Netanyahu overplayed his hand when he went after Hamas leaders in Doha. I think that was something he was doing for the far right of his party, and it didn't it ended up backfiring a little bit, and so he now has to scramble a little bit. And if I can do one more thing before we pass it over to Malia, footnote, just a footnote to Jim's accurate and you know, spot on analysis. The footnote here is the I have this sinking feeling that the Jared Kushners and the Ivanka Trumps are the future Republican leaders. J.D. Vance certainly, but are the future Republican leaders. And I think Jared and Ivanka were smart to get out of the Trump administration the second time around. And to use the metaphor again, parachute in this moment, because I actually think, especially Ivanka, has eyes a future in politics, and this is super helpful that she was able to help negotiate this particular deal. Just a footnote.
I agree with Beau. And as for the letter writer, that just explains one side of the equation, right? Hamas would have continued to resist. I mean, they've shown as most insurgent or terrorist groups do, they can't be bombed into submission. There's no way to militarily defeat them as long as they continue to have external support. So it wasn't just Trump being a bully. It's not just Netanyahu being a bully. It's the fact that Hamas also felt backed into a corner and felt like they had to take, and not because of just bullying from Netanyahu and the terrible things that he did in Gaza. They would have continued to resist if they had continued to have external support from the Arab states.
We'll take a break, hold there, and when we come back, we'll continue and move on to other stories. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. First, before we get to all of that, we'll go to news with David Castina. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this October 13th. It's a Monday, and we appreciate you all being with us. Joseph Palamountain, Chair in Government at Skidmore College. Beau Breslin joins us, Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia DeMont, and Senior Fellow at Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer. We welcome your letters. I just have a few letters holdover from the conversation we were having moments ago regarding the regarding what happened in the Middle East and the Gaza summit that's about to occur. And so let me just go to those quickly, and then we'll move on and talk about the shutdown. Gordon writes, Trump did what he could to end the war in the Middle East because he wants to receive the Nobel Peace Prize. He did not do it because of he has empathy for the people of Gaza or Israel. He just wants that prize because Obama got it, and he deeply resents that. That is all the credit Trump should be given. He did something good for the most base personal reason. We got a couple of letters.
Can I just say, Joe, whatever the reason, if the shooting has stopped and people aren't being killed, in my book, that's something positive and worth getting some credit for, agreed, irrespective of the reason.
Agreed.
Matt writes, let's not overlook the fact that the disagreement was shoehorned in just prior to the Peace Prize selection. We got a couple letters like that. We forget that 145 hostages were released to Israel under the Biden administration. Mm-hmm. And also, Christina says, Trump promised to cease fire on day one. We're almost a year in. If he would have stopped the flow of weapons, it would have been stopped. He couldn't. Take two. He could have insisted on aid being allowed in. He didn't do either of those things, so he deserves no credit. That from Christine.
Well, I mean, I think I'll respond to this by echoing what Malia started by saying, right? So I would never suggest that Biden didn't do his very best, worked hard to get to the ceasefire in the temporary ceasefire that he was able to do. But this moment is different, and that's one thing I think the press has done a good job of, and this is what Malia was talking about, right? So Hamas leadership is destroyed. Hamas patron in Iran is weak. Hezbollah is in tatters. The Houthis are incapable of conducting a war. They may not be quite as bad as Hezbollah, but they're incapable of a widespread war. Hamas is unpopular. It's a different landscape now, and then you add some of the other things, than when Biden was. So If we're making a comparison between how successful Biden was and how successful Trump has been, you can make a considerable argument that Biden got more out of his moment than Trump got out of this particular moment. That is to say, though, Biden couldn't get over the finish line, and I don't know if the finish line is a real finish line, but Trump was able to do that.
Let's go to the shutdown and talk about what is happening. This from the Washington Post. The ongoing government shutdown will collide with the U.S. economy this week as missed paychecks and the absence of billions of dollars of government services reverberate beyond federal workers and sting the broader public. President Donald Trump and lawmakers in Congress remain deadlocked heading into a third week of shuttered federal agencies. Republicans control both chambers of Congress, but lack the votes in the Senate to defeat a filibuster of legislation to fund ongoing operations. Democrats insist that Trump and the GOP must cut a deal to preserve health insurance subsidies as part of an agreement to reopen the government. The shutdown has already caused nationwide flight delays, closed taxpayer helplines at the Internal Revenue Service, snarled permitting approvals at the Environmental Protection Agency and the Transportation Department, as well as shut off access to national parks, including this week to the Smithsonian Museums. Workers vital to national security and protecting government property remain on the job unpaid, but others, some 750,000, according to congressional bookkeepers, have been furloughed. The Trump administration laid off some 4,000 workers. Hello, train. let me turn that off. On Sunday, the president ordered the Pentagon to repurpose. The Trump administration laid off some 4,000 workers on Friday. On Sunday, the president ordered the Pentagon to repurpose research and development funding to make payroll for members of the military who were set to miss their first paycheck on Wednesday. But civilian employees won't see the same treatment. And the Trump administration's budget office also argued in a draft opinion last week that furloughed workers are not entitled to back pay when the shutdown ends. Wow.
This is a tricky moment, because most shutdowns in the past, and I'm going post-Reagan administration, have been very short, right? And then you have the 35-day one that happened in Trump's first administration. This is a tricky middle ground moment. And so I actually think this shutdown is going to continue to last for another couple weeks, even though I saw a headline today, either in the Post or the New York Times, saying Congress members are getting a little panicky at this moment because of the shutdown going on. And I'll say one more thing before I hand it over to the fellow panelists. This is also a very tricky moment because of foreign policy, because of the ceasefire in Gaza, because the Democrats not only want to hold on to the domestic agenda with regard to health care, but they don't want to give Trump two significant victories in a row. So I actually think the moment of the situation in the Middle East actually will prevent further negotiations or movement on the part of Democrats, because they can't afford to give two victories in a row to the Republicans.
Well, yeah.
I think this shutdown, and unfortunately it's not the first shutdown, probably won't be the last, but it's qualitatively different than most of the previous shutdowns, which occurred because Democrats and Republicans had different policy priorities and they didn't want to budge. This is not just about policy priorities. This is about a war on government versus a war to save government. Because the Republicans led by President Trump, they're not just standing their ground because they want to, you know, win some policy debate. The government shutdown is good news for them because it gives them an excuse to further cut the government in ways that seem like they're probably not legal either. But I was on a Zoom meeting with Congressman Ryan on Friday, who called together a bunch of nonprofit leaders in his district to strategize and hear about how the region is going to be affected. What are the key issues? And the shutdown is coming. This is not it's not an isolated event. It's coming in the context of these huge cuts that have already been made to government. So a lot of the people who are going to be most affected by the shutdown are already being affected by all the cuts that already took place. So, you know, I'm particularly keyed into the veterans community, for example, and 80,000 jobs have been cut from VA facilities across the country. So it's not just veterans and, you know, receiving care or not receiving care at the very fine facilities that we as citizens have paid for veterans to have access to, or student veterans getting their benefits, their student veteran benefits processed in a timely manner. But there were already delays in those things happening. And now there's just, on top of delays, it's just uncertainty, like greater uncertainty. And that my heart just bleeds for all my friends in government who, I don't know anyone who works in government who doesn't have a heart for public service. People don't just take a government job because it's the easy thing to do. You have to jump through a lot of hoops to get a government job. It's not easy to keep one. The bureaucracy is often difficult to deal with. And you do it because you feel like you are making a difference. And most people I know in government could make a lot more money outside government. They choose, their priorities are not that. Their priorities are to serve. And it's just punishment for them. It's punishing their desire to serve, which I, as someone who works with young people every day, trying to help them understand how our government works and hoping that some of them will choose to make that choice to go into public service, because we need that. Our society can't exist without, you know, volunteerism and people wanting to devote their lives to helping our system perpetuate itself. I really worry about how it affects their decision. They see that, okay, you can go into government and you're going to be thwarted and you're going to be fired or your pay is going to be taken away. The uncertainty that goes with it and the bullying of people who are just trying to do the right thing is it's in addition to all the harm that these cuts are doing, especially in things like food insecurity. Just people are hungrier. It's a tragedy. But it perpetuates itself longer because of, I think, the longstanding effect that it will have on young people who are watching this happen.
Well, I just want to follow up on, you know, on that issue about the people who work in our governmental institutions. I mean, this is not, you know, just the government shutdown. Of course, this has been going on from the very first day of the Trump administration. People I know who are, you know, deeply committed to government service, who have represented our country around the world in some very difficult places, have been unceremoniously shown the door after years of service, lots of important experience going out the door, and labeled in some cases, and this is a direct quote, radical lunatics by the President of the United States and Elon Musk when he was at the forefront of DOGE. It's absolutely outrageous. It's absolutely wrong. And it's also a complete, you know, wounding of our own country to do this to our institutions. Many people voted for Donald Trump because they saw government as too big. I think many people also didn't have a vision of what would replace this. And so it's just kind of burned down the system with no plan of what to do next. And I think the shutdown just highlights that. The shutdown also gives the Republicans an opportunity to blame the Democrats and to say, well, now this is happening because the Democrats are being intransigent. And the Democrats have made a strategic decision to have the shutdown be about health care. Solely about healthcare as a political issue, and not about these things that we're talking about right now. Not about the attack on institutions, the overall attack on democracy. Not about lawlessness. Not about this, unprecedented accumulation of executive power. The Democrats on the Hill have apparently made the decision that stuff has no political traction. And so we should focus on healthcare, which is, of course, important. We should focus, you know, in for the midterm elections on these kinds of, you know, bread and butter issues for the American voter and these other things about democracy, et cetera. These are, you know, too abstract. I disagree with that strategy, but we'll see how it plays out as a political football within Washington. But more broadly, the things you're talking about, Malia. You know, I don't know how we could even envision being able to piece back together what has already been broken in just a few months.
So let me put the three of you on the spot for a second and ask a question that I'm absolutely...
Haven't we been through enough this week?
Pressure's on. I think it'll be a softball, but I'm flummoxed by Trump... Many of Trump's policies, and I'm going to draw some broad stereotypes, many of Trump's policies target those who we would traditionally think of as in his base. So I'm thinking in particular with regard to soybean farmers, for example, who can't. I saw the head of the soybean farmer organization say, we can't make ends meet, or the tariffs that target particular folks who can't afford X, Y, and Z. Or the people say, Malia, help me out here, the MAGA, there's a certain percentage of veterans and or those in the armed forces who are not getting paychecks now who are also MAGA supporters. Are we back? So here's the softball. Are we back in a Reagan moment where he's a Teflon president and anything he does against his own base doesn't have an impact on his popularity?
I don't think that's what's going to happen. I can imagine that if, let's take the example of soybean farmers, if that turns into something that a lot of Republicans are concerned about, I can imagine the Trump administration, like they've ordered the Department of Defense to repurpose some of this research money to pay troops paychecks, that they'll find some way to pay those soybean farmers. I think that structurally, from a political base perspective, the Republicans are more able to weather this shutdown than the Democrats are, because though you're right, a lot of policies impact Trump's base. They actually disproportionately affect Democrats. So all the people I was on the Zoom call with on Friday, all the nonprofits that are serving not only veterans, but the food banks, the various educational organizations. I mean, that tends to be those are Democrat-leaning or people that are serving voters who tend to vote more Democrat. And I just think in numbers-wise, Trump is probably happy to let those larger number of people suffer. And that's going to end up putting more pressure on the Democrats. I think a lot of Democrats are already feeling. I agree with Jim. I felt like from the beginning, it's like, I'm not sure this is a – I don't think this is a good strategy for the Democrats. I think it's going to be really hard for them to remain unified around this, because they're basically asking a big part of their base to suffer in order to try to get this health care through, which it's a worthy goal, but – It seems like a miscalculation.
But to your point and the question, the quote unquote softball, I mean, yeah, like the Teflon has been there almost from the beginning, and it hasn't scratched or peeled or flaked off in any meaningful way, shape, or form.
Pumped full of formaldehyde, so it just...
Yeah, right. I mean, it's just... Right. I mean, it doesn't seem... It's been... I mean, from the election on, it has been there and doesn't seem to... Now, he'll give you 150,000 reasons as to how he's been maligned, but when you look... To me, when you look at what he is able to politically get through relatively unscathed, it's a really long list.
But I think also it's an insight into the fact that a lot of what propels the support for Donald Trump, irrespective of what has happened at any given moment and where he stands on any given policy, is that it's not about policy. And it's about identity and many other things that have mobilized this movement. It's not just a political party. In fact, it's not really the Republican Party that we grew up with. This is a movement that is centered around other things beyond policy. I mean, we've seen Donald Trump shift on policy multiple times with zero effect on his political standing. And I think the extent to which the leadership in the Democratic Party fails to grasp that, they will continue to be on the losing side of these political battles.
Yeah, and one more thing I'll add to Jim, I think that's exactly right. And one more thing I'll add to it, and I'm sure that there will be listeners, Joe, who are going to write to you scathing remarks, but Democrats, especially Democratic leadership, think the country is more progressive than it is. And the only one I heard the other day, the only president... Obama was great. Obama's one of my heroes. But Clinton understood that the Democrat, that the country was not as left-wing as most people were willing to say. And I think we're sort of back in that period of time where Chuck Schumer, Hakeem Jeffries, and the leadership think that the country is more progressive and left-wing. Until the Democrats realize that, in addition to what Jim just said, I think it's a losing, at least a losing presidential cause. Yeah. It may not be a losing congressional cause in 2026, but at least a losing presidential cause.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up a couple more items to discuss in the news. As always, we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Bo Breslin, Malia Dumont, and Jim Ketterer make up our panel this morning. And again, we welcome your thoughts. Last call for letters as we go through our final topics in the last 15 or 20 minutes upon our return. We'll take a break and be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. And we've got about 15 minutes or so and can look at a couple of more comments this morning. I would like to talk about the story out of the this is from the New York Times, but it was came from the remarks made by the Vice President of the United States, J.D. Vance, in an interview on NBC's Meet the Press, saying that crime is out of control in major U.S. cities. Vice President Vance was looking, said that President Trump was, quote, looking at all of his options to deploy the National Guard in major cities, including invoking the Insurrection Act of 1807. Bo, get ready. Which grants the president emergency powers to deploy troops on U.S. soil during major unrest. In an interview on Meet the Press, Mr. Vance said Mr. Trump has not felt he needed to invoke the Insurrection Act right now, but he has not ruled it out. That is the vice president's answer to what Mr. Trump said last week, saying he saw the Insurrection Act, quote, as a way to get around recent court rulings blocking his efforts to deploy the Guard to fight crime and put down protests against the government's crackdown on undocumented immigrants. So perhaps a little bit of walking back there by the vice president. Bo.
Guess how many times the Insurrection Act has been invoked? 30 times
All right.
since 1807.
When was the most recent, do you know?
1992.
Okay.
Rodney King,
George
H.W. Bush. But here's the interesting thing. So, I'm guessing that Malia knows this stuff backwards and forward. The interesting thing is that the Insurrection Act has three sections, two of which are the ones that are typically invoked. And those are the ones where the state, usually the state legislature, but not always, the governor, invites the federal troops to come. And that's what happened with George H.W. Bush. The governor of California invited President Bush to send troops to deal with the riots in Los Angeles. What Trump and Vance, and I saw that interview on Meet the Press with Kristen Welker, what Vance is talking about is Section 252, where the president does not get the invitation from the state and brings in troops. Now, that's a very different approach that has historically been used in the past. So the sections where you're invited are the ones that typically have been done in the past, and even those where military troops have not been invited, it's been for the purpose, this is real, of enforcing Brown versus Board of Education and so on. So now we're in an environment in which the president is going to send in military troops uninvited and not for what I would describe as moral civil rights issues like desegregation in the South.
Thank you for that, because I don't actually know this stuff backwards and forwards. Although, as you said, Bo, this act has been invoked 30 times, it's still a relatively rare occurrence. And when I was working on Homeland Defense Policy, which includes oversight of the National Guard, when I was in the Pentagon, I never, like, this never came across my desk and never came anywhere near my desk. So I haven't really dealt with these specific legal issues before. I just want to point out, it's kind of an ironic headline today in one of the military newspapers I follow. It's called Task and Purpose. The headline is, "Some Texas National Guard troops were placed in Illinois after failing to meet standards." So let me just read to you what kind of standards they failed to meet. A spokesperson for the Texas Military Department confirmed that a small group of the 200 National Guard members sent to Illinois this past week had been replaced after they were found to not meet certain standards. The move came amid criticism on social media over pictures that showed some of the Guard members appearing to be overweight, and as an appeals corps temporarily blocked the deployment of the Texan troops. So they go on to say that the Texas National Guard mobilized these folks in, quote, in less than 24 hours and deployed them. So I've been getting questions from some people about, you know, who are these troops? What are they going to be doing and who are they? And I think especially when you're talking about such small numbers, 200 people from the entire state of Texas, which has a pretty sizable National Guard for a 3-month mission. A lot of young people who are in the Guard are going to volunteer for a mission. They're not necessarily volunteering for the mission. It's not that they want to go quell an uprising in Chicago. They're volunteering for 3 months of, in normal times, a steady paycheck and 3 months that helps them earn more retirement points towards a very beneficial military retirement that brings not just military pay but all kinds of other benefits. And they're mainly pretty young troops and young enlisted troops, which by the way, happens to have a pretty significant percentage of members who are Black or Latino. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about, in many cases, people who may have joined the military because they want to earn money for college, or they come from disadvantaged backgrounds, and this is a way to help them get ahead, who are trying to earn a paycheck. And people generally don't join the military because of certain policies. They join it for the economic opportunity, or sometimes because they have a real sense of wanting to serve in some broader way. But I guess some of them were a little bit overweight, and despite Pete Hegseth's, exhortations to the contrary.
Well, I just want to follow on that, too, and say, number one, we know from the statistics that what J.D. Vance was saying was about crime being out of control in several of these cities is not quite right, but it's enough right that it finds traction, particularly among people who don't live in a city or live in those cities. So it plays well politically, even though it isn't factually correct. And also, if you look into a lot of the crime statistics in these cities where there are areas where there's lots of crime, this is not the kind of crime that is going to be addressed by sending young enlisted troops from another state. They are not trained to do that. These are deeper-seated, long-standing sociological issues that have to be addressed in a different way. They haven't been in some cases, and that is a problem. But if you want to really address that problem, if you're serious about addressing that problem from Washington, you need to do something else other than send in troops. I think J.D. Vance knows that deep down. And I think that these troops are not going to red cities because of crime issues. I think that they are being sent to normalize the stationing of federalized troops who are coming from red states in anticipation of the 2026 midterm elections, in anticipation of some places having close elections, and those elections perhaps being called into question. Maybe there would be protests about that, and there are troops there to address those protests or otherwise crack down on those protests. Or there would be troops there to seize the ballot machines or what have you. This is not just me saying this. Guess what? The governor of Illinois, Governor Pritzker, said this out loud in an interview just a few days ago. He said that, you know, the Department of Justice is taking election data from all of the 50 states, including theirs. They appear to be laying the foundation for something more that's going to be happening in what it's likely to be very close midterm elections. And as I said before, in a previous conversation on air today, Donald Trump sees these elections as absolutely existential for his administration and for his standing as president. And so I don't buy for a minute that these troops are going to these places because of crime. And I think that we will see how this plays out over the next few months, but it's likely to be a very dark scenario.
Joe, it seems highly unlikely that you would remember back on September 3rd when I was on the show and said some version of this is the great. So it was at that point that Trump was this. I looked it up. September 2nd was the day he sort of threatened to send troops to Chicago. And I was on the show on September 3rd, and I said, this is the greatest thing that's happened to J.B. Pritzker, because if he can sustain this, if Trump continues to focus on Chicago, and I said, Obama's from Chicago, Hillary Clinton's from Chicago, he hates Chicago, J.B. Pritzker is going to be able to ride this to be the most prominent Democratic governor. He's going to surpass Josh Shapiro as the most prominent, and Gretchen Whitmer, I think. Gavin Newsom is in a category by himself. And here, Jim, you just said 3 days ago you saw him again on the, yeah. It is remarkable how much this is going to help J.B. Pritzker when he decides to run for president. And J.B. Pritzker has one liability. What's that liability? He's a billionaire. It's going to be hard to play in the Democratic Party, but if he's the one who stands up, and what was it, 4 or 5 days ago, where the front page of the New York Times said some version of J.B. Pritzker is tired of Democrats not yes. standing up to
yeah.
Trump,
yeah.
right? So Pritzker's now the sort of the top of the heap on the Democratic Party, which is an interesting moment for those of us who are Democrats.
I think it's the Midwestern Democrats who understand what you pointed out earlier, Beau, which is that the Democrats across the country are not as progressive as many in the Democratic Party leadership think they are. Mm. It's the Midwestern Democrats that understand that.
We're going to take a we're going to end at this moment where we have the Congressional Corner coming up. My thanks to Beau Breslin, to Jim Ketterer, and Malia DeMont. Thank you all so much for being here today. Appreciate it. Great show. We will return right after this short break.